and it just healed from the inside out. That's how long it takes to heal.
That's the only way a cut really
heals.
Yeah, it
would heal. Of course, any cut heals from inside out, but we'd just keep a bleeding, dried up and dried up and dried up, and we'd bleed till we didn't hardly have any blood in our bodies. And it eventually stopped. After it had a scab on it, I've bled with my nose. We've had nose bleeds, just pour the blood, just keep a bleeding, keep a bleeding.
Did you ever think you were going to die when you were a kid, bleeding like that?
No, I never gave no thought. I just didn't. I don't know about Jimmy, but I didn't have the realization that I was in that kind of a shape, see. That's why I never bothered me any. If I would have, I'd have been a nervous wreck, Michael.
Well, after you did find out, what was your mental attitude?
Then it was different. When I went to Morgantown University, after I went down there the first time. Well, Jimmy was back down there in the early 60s when they opened that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And they didn't really know that much about it then down there. And it wasn't built up that much, university wasn't. And I went to Elkins with an abscess tooth. And it was a kill me, a bust.
Our December 29th interview with Jimmy and Lodi Currents. And Jack, you had just raised the question about how Lodi felt once he found out what he had. Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah, and you said that it really hadn't bothered you so much, because you just didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
When you found out what it was, what kind of effect did that have on you mentally, psychologically, physically?
Right, yeah, it did. I started to tell you when I went to Morgantown there, the doctor sent me down there with an abscessed jaw, and they examined me, and I don't know how many doctors examined me, and of course they found out what I had, and they said, "Do you know what shape you're in, kind of shape you're in?" I said, "Well, I think I do." I said, "I've had it long enough." And they said, "No, you don't either." Said, "You're a severe hemophiliac bleeder." And said, "You could bleed to death like that." And of course, that there set the cork off right there. And it started, you know, me to thinking. And it had an effect on my only psychological and nervousness and mental and everything. And from then on, we went to Morgantown I was called back by telegram after I went down there. They released me. They was go pull my tooth, but they didn't, because it's abscessed too bad, and they give me some antibiotics to take it out. And I got a telegram in the post office saying for me to report to the hematologist at the university on a certain date. I've still got the telegram at the house. And Dr. Mabel M. Stevenson was the woman that I got it from. She was a hematologist. And I went down there, and they drawed blood out of me, and they asked me my life's history about myself, if I had any brothers, if I had any nephews and everything like that. And I said, I've got a brother living, and I've got a nephew living with it. And the next time, all three of us went down. That was Jimmy and I and Malcolm.
What year was that?
That was in the late 60s. In the late 60s, I think. No, that could have been in the early sort of 60s, wasn't it? I think you was down there in the 50s, the late 50s, and we went down there in the early 60s, is the way it was. And that's about when it was, in the early 60s.
But there wasn't any real organized concern about you until Dr. Stevenson.
Not a bit in the world.
The telegram.
That's right. There wasn't no real concern about us till we got the telegram. I got the telegram, and I went, and she'd taken blood out of me, drawn blood out of me, and she said, "I've got to see your brother, and I've got to see your nephew. I've got to know your life history and see if you had any more in the family and whatnot." And from that time, we went once a month. regulars a month come to check our blood, to give blood, and for the lab to work with it, the hematologist to work with it down at the University in Morgantown.
Had Dr. Stevenson been in the first group of doctors that, when you went for your abscess tooth?
Or no, she just found out about that after I'd left. She'd never seen me.
She found out and moved into action, didn't she?
Right, but we're the worst hemophiliac bleeders that's been in that university hospital, except in one, and he lives down in Philippi, below Philippi. His name's Early Polo, and I know he wouldn't worry about me mentioning his name, and the factor VIII will not take a hold in him. He built up an antibody to it. And ours is down to zero factor. Our factor VIII's down to zero. And other hemophiliacs they've got there, some of them's got 8% in it, which is good. And some of them's got higher than that.
The zero factor refers to the ability of your blood to clot?
Right. The zero factor is, the zero factor is severe classical hemophiliac bleeder.
What would be if I were average, what would mine be?
If you was normal, if you're
yeah,
normal, like,
normal.
Well, from anywhere from 70 to 80, maybe 100%. And a hemophiliac bleeder, if he's got 30% in his blood, he's counted a hemophiliac bleeder, but you never notice it till major surgery. And of course, if you drop on, I mean, he could go through the army. There was two of them down there that I knew in Morgantown. Their names was McBees, and they was in the army, but they was hemophiliac bleeders, but they wasn't severe. Their blood factor, clotting factor was up into 30, but they was still counted hemophiliac bleeders, but they wasn't severe hemophiliacs.
Getting back into High Germany for a minute, what happened in the wintertime when you would take these spells? How did they get you out?
We didn't go out. We laid in there and suffered. We never went to the doctor that much. Only when we was in our teens is when we started going to the doctor. And if we got a sprain, a hemorrhage knee or a hemorrhage arm or a hemorrhage foot in the wintertime, we stayed at home. And we stayed at home the biggest part of the time in the summertime.
Weren't there times when you had to get out to the doctor, though, when you were back in there?
After we was growing up, there were times that we had to get out. We had to hire.
What happened then?
We had to hire somebody to take us out that had a car. That's scary after we think about it, ain't it? we really didn't go to
in our teens. In our teens, like when we got up in the teens, like when I had one bleeding spell with my stomach, and then growing up through there, and I had to go to a doctor at Buckhannon.
Yeah, that's right.
And he gave me the only thing that saved me was my brother-in-law had given me a pint of blood at the time.
Yeah, that, right.
The doctor then told me, he said, it's a wonder I hadn't went into convulsions and died right then, but somewhere or another, I survived by taking this pint of blood from my brother-in-law right at the time. He gave me blood, and I done fine after I got the pint of blood, but it was off and on. You'd take a spell. You just, I don't know, as when you was a boy and you was active, as we was, you just continuously kept getting hurt, but as soon as you got over a spell, you still wanted to go. You still had the guts to keep right on going. I did. I mean, there's something about my life and my willpower that I liked to farm so well that I liked.
So you learned to work hard.
And you're right, and keep it going. Just keep right on.
You worked in the woods, and you worked.
We fooled around with everything. We made rails with our dad.
Hurdle rails are called rustus fences.
Yeah, made hurdle rails with our dad, and we cut wood, and used axes and everything else. But now,
days
we wouldn't dare to use an axe or fooling around and stuff like that.
Those are all the things you shouldn't have been doing.
Right. Things we should have been doing. You know, the doctor said, well, you could have cut your foot and bled to death in a matter of seconds, which is, he was right. But we didn't, we took a dare to do them things. Rode horses, put up hay, used pitchforks.
Sizes. Crosscut saws.
Crosscut saws.
Saw wood.
You name it, we did it.
And didn't have no chainsaws them time.
But I would say this for a fact. I would never, even a hemophilian growing up today, I would encourage him not to be afraid. Not to be afraid or not to let something like that get him down, because there's something, if you let something get you down, after a while, it'll throw you clean in the dumps.
Well, they've got a better chance than we had.
In fact, they've got a better chance now than we ever had it growing up. They've got the factor eight where we didn't have it back then.
Right, that's why we're crippled.
And I would encourage him to just to go on about their business like there's nothing wrong.
Well, you've got that job ahead of you, don't you?
Right.
I mean, to encourage. Mm-hmm. You have a grandson.
Yeah,
you
right.
You have to get a lot of encouragement.
That's right. And that's why I'd advise him not to let him worry him. As he said before, it did worry me. It had me with a nervous breakdown almost there at one time. In fact, I was afraid to go anywhere.
After you found out what you had.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. After I found out what I had, I was afraid to go anywhere. I mean, I got to the point where I was a nervous wreck. I even went to the doctors, and I thought of everything I seen, I was going to die. See, I had death on my mind because because the people kept telling me. People that's passed away told me, well, he won't live no time. You can't live no time because you're a hemophilia. That was people I grew up and went to school with over there. So I went to doctors, and he said, well, did you ever stop to think of your sitting in the house? The only time I'd go out, I was afraid to go out, I'd be sitting in the house all the time. He said, the house could cave in on you and kill you. He said, you might as well enjoy yourself. Of course, he snapped me out of it, and I got over it. And I just felt that, heck, life's life, and you'll live till you die, just go on. I just got to thinking about it. And I figured there's a higher power, like God would take care of me, see.
Your lack of fear was your protection.
Right. That's exactly right. Lack of fear.
That's what protected you all those mm-hmm. years.
Well, another thing protected us too, I can't keep from believing this. We had a praying mother. Mm-hmm. And she done a lot of praying for us and trusting in the Lord. I think that had everything in the world to do with it. In fact, I know it is.
That's
okay. Well, it's like he just and a praying father too.
Yeah.
I mean, they was God-fearing people, and my mother was, so ain't my daddy is yet today.
Well, there's no doubt. There's
no doubt in my mind. I mean, this there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that God Himself kept us. Faith and our ability to keep it going with this condition.
I know there's not no doubt in my mind, because there ain't no other way we could survive.
What was the feeling and attitude of your parents during all this, when you were growing up particularly? I mean, what did they do, and what was their, I know they prayed very hard, but what other things did they do, or how were they feeling through your growing up with all these problems?
Well, my mother, she was alert after that, after the one boy bled to death. And she cautioned us. Everything that we do, she'd say, don't do this, or don't get into that, or try to watch and not jump like the other kids jump off of buildings and climb trees and things like that. She cautioned us not to do that, but like boys, you know, we done that. We still went ahead and done it. That's why we was hurt a lot, see. We get hurt because, you know, we'd go out and we was adventurers because we liked to do them things. And we'd walk rail fences and we'd have black and blue marks on us all the time. But see, we never give it no thought of being in that shape. But still she would caution us about our condition. And we just went right ahead and done tried to do what the other boys done.
I think she worried more, Lou, and really, and Daddy. course, I don't know, maybe by being a mother, I think a mother has got more of a tendency. I know a father would worry too. I worried, you know, about my kids, but I think a mother's nature to worry more. Mom was more to worry about it than daddy. And in fact, I don't think he really realized our condition.
No, not as much as she did. Did.
Uh-uh. Because he'd have us out, you know, on the sleds, a-tromping hay, and helping with the horses and stuff. And he didn't really realize as much as she did about it.
You mentioned to me once before that lots of people said about you that, gee, they won't live, you know, to be grown men and such as that. When did that sort of thing start?
Well, that started when we was back over on the farm, you know.
What was the attitude of the neighbors and the other children?
Well, they didn't seem to, the attitude of the school mates, you know, some of them was a little protective as with us, you know, they'd watched, but others didn't. They didn't pay no attention to it.
They didn't understand it,
really. In fact, when I started the high school. I got my eighth grade diploma from over there at the High Germany School when I was on the farm. I got my eighth grade diploma there, and then I started the high school. But it got to the point where I couldn't, in the older schoolhouse at Colton, I couldn't climb up and down the stairs, back and forth and change rooms and classes. I got to look, it hurt me so bad, and then I'd have to skip so much it just got next to me, and I couldn't take it. And not like I say, as we was younger, or growing up, we was hurt more, didn't have no medicine to take. If we'd have had the medicine, and after Factor VIII we'd have had the day, I think we could have went along and went to school and finished and got an education, more of an education, which would have been good, but we couldn't get it. Just on account of having no medicine, no way of paying for that kind of expensive medicine.
What was it like, though, in the one-room school? Can you describe that a little bit? You told me today as many as 45 kids going to that school at a time.
Well, we had a good time when we went to school together.
You had all 8 grades together with one teacher?
No, one through 8.
1 through 8.
All 8 grades.
All 8 grades, yeah.
I think it was an enjoyable time. The kids seemed to get along good, and they'd have them double seats, you know, where they'd
two would sit in them.
And we had a real good time.
Did the older kids help teach the younger ones at all, or?
In some ways they would, and then you know, the older ones was higher up in the grades would help the.
Yeah, they helped out.
And they brought teachers in, you know, from Board of Education, brought them in from, sent them over there, because it was the only way they could teach over there. It was the board. Somebody most of the time they boarded with us there, in our farm.
Do you remember a particular teacher that's outstanding in your mind?
Yeah, I remember Nellie Lambert. I remember Avonelle Loudon, Mrs. Church lives over here. I reckon she still lives at Daly, doesn't she?
Valley Bend.
And Eleanor Farner taught me. Eleanor Farney taught me went to school, and Herbert Dodrell, which he's of course passed away now.
Was Eleanor a pretty keen teacher?
She was a fine teacher. And there was several more teachers taught school in there.
Was the school the center of the community's activities and things like Christmas?
Right.
Tell about that a little bit.
Well, it served as our church. That was our church on our get-togetherings in the whole community. That schoolhouse was. That served as our church and school and activities and everything that went on.
What happened at Christmas time?
Well, they just have a Christmas play like they do at any other. I thought it was better than most schools. I mean, not a saying the modern schools got them, but back then, to me, it was really something, because most of the time they'd work up their own plays, and there was people come from all the way, miles, you know, walk to see that, and big crowds come to attend them.
Were there people in the community who were in the play too, besides school kids?
Yeah, they'd be grown-ups take part in it too, as well as the kids that went to school.
Sounds wonderful.
It was.
What about Easter? Did they have an Easter play?
Oh, too? Yeah, they always had an Easter play, and they'd have an Easter egg hunt for the kids. And they'd have the eggs hid all over. And then on the, after our, when I was in school growing up, he can remember too, they'd take, they'd have a Easter egg hunt. Not or will forget, they'd take the kids away out on that farm somewhere on some of them flats I showed you back there, clean back on a picnic.
That was the end of the school year.
End of the school year, and take us on picnics away back.
And all the families would go
all
together.
All the families would go and go together.
They'd have a tremendous meal to eat. You know, they had it. They put it on the ground on tablecloths, and they wouldn't have no tables, but it was right on the ground. I remember that.
What games did you play as a kid? Do you remember any of the games?
We had a game we called Base and Banner. I don't know whether you ever heard of that or not. We called Base and Banner, and then we played Hide and Go Seek. And what was some? Can you
kick
think
the
of
can? Did you play kick the can?
I don't know whether we played that or not. We played with a sponge ball. We'd play ball.
What was Base and Banner? Was that what
Base and Banner? I see you teamed up as well as I can remember. There'd be four or five get in a team, and they'd be so far apart, each team would, and they'd have bases. And one would try maybe to go around the other one, and if the other one tagged him, they got him on that their side. And whoever got the most people on their side was the winners. That's what they call Base and Banner. It was really a lot of fun.
Of course, they had the
sack. And if somebody would go off base, if the other team was somebody, he could get down there and tag the base, and they could break them up. That would be the game.
Well, we done a lot of snow rolling in the wintertime. You know,
yeah,
we
made snowmen and played a lot of Antony over.
Make snowmen.
With a ball, rubber balls.
I mean, it's just.
You wrote what?
We rode the skippers.
Skippers?
This is what they call the skipper. We call them a skipper. The people call them Godel, but we call them a skipper. Cause
can you describe a skipper? Where is that?
Well, a skipper, it had a board across and then a straight down piece. And then it had
a sole.
One one sole, like on
runner.
A sled runner. And then it had braces for the seat, and the braces are going down to hold it that way.
So it was like a ski with a seat on it?
Right. That's like a ski with a seat on it.
And what we how far could you go on one of those things?
Well, we'd get on top of one of them hills, and we could ride. I showed you today, it was a pretty good distance. You could get on top of one of them hills and go all the way down the bottoms.
The only thing about one of them hard about riding them is walking back up over the hill and carry the skipper.
Were there any special beliefs you had as kids? Did you tell stories about haints or spells or any of that kind of stuff? Or were there beliefs like that at all in the community? Were any of the older people believe in ghosts or signs or?
Yeah.
Signs.
You know, they believed in signs. And they believed in, well, they actually believed in, some of them believed in ghosts. I mean, you know, especially my one grandmother, and I couldn't doubt her words on a few things she see.
Tell me about what she said.
Well, she told us one time when her grandfather was a walking from a place. He said there was another guy with him walking, and there was a walking to work, and there's a dog with him. He kept us saying there's a dog following you. And they said, no, there's no dog there. But he saw the dog. And he said, yeah, he said, I see the dog. And after they come to this graveyard, this dog just went out and disappeared. Of course, they was one of her boys, one of my grandmothers on my mother's side. He could almost detect somebody when they died over there. I mean, I don't know, he had where it was ESP or what, but he when he come in, they started telling him somebody, said, "Don't tell me," said, "I already know that somebody died." Of course, they had a big old bell over there in the church, one of them church, but every time the church bell rang, you knew that somebody died.
Every time.
Unless it was on a Sunday morning. But if somebody died, they rung that church bell so many times in that community where we lived. You'd hear the church bell ring, you know there's somebody dead in the community.
So he had sort of special powers, this kid did? He could...
He must have done it because he had a cat. They had a cat at one of these at home together. And my grandmother told him, said it was time for him to put the cat out and go to bed. He said, "No," he said, "I'm going to stay up a little bit longer." She said, "Now you got to get up early in the morning, put the cat out and come to bed." But in this particular night, he stayed up a little bit longer with the cat. Now, this was truth and come from my grandmother. And I believe her because everything she told me, I never seen her tell no lies whatsoever. And he sat up with this cat that night late. And she kept telling him to come to bed. And she finally told him for the last time, you know, they only told kids back at that time one or two times, and that was it. And he knew to come. Well, he said, "I'll come, Mom." And he called the cat Tom. He said, "Well, Tom," he said, "I'll put you out, but," he said, "I'll never see you no more." And he never did see the cat no more. And she said he never did. He said really never saw the cat no more.
This was your...
My grandmother's son.
So it was your mother's brother.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have any other kinds of special powers? Or? What about healing? Did he do any healing, or were there healers of any kind in the community?
Well, there was a woman over there. They said
they tried. There's one somebody in the community one time tried to stop the blood in one of us, but they couldn't.
They never could stop it. She claimed she could heal, and she had like power to if any little kid was sick, to heal. But I never saw none of it happen myself. I really never seen it. And I never saw no ghosts as they spoke of.
Only one time we seen I remember that just as well as yesterday. We was very small. And we went outside for something Jimmy can remember. And it was before World War II. And everybody, you know, they thought it was the Northern Lights. You know, you've seen the Northern Lights shoot up like this, how they flash. But anyway, this one particular night was, I think it was early 40s. We went out and it was dark and we was very small. And I told Jimmy, I said, "Look up at the sky." I said, "It's awful peculiar." I said, "It's very interesting." I said, "It's red, just as red as it can be." And the sky was in a quiver like this.
Just looked like jelly.
Nobody would believe it. It scared them. The people through that country were scared to death. And it was just a quivering like this all the time. It just looked like red jello in it. And some of them even seen the American flag in it. And I can't get the younger generation. They just don't believe things like that. But that was the only time it ever happened. And right after that, World War II broke out.
I saw that. That was. That
it was weird. It scared people. People got out of bed and run and everything. It scared them. They thought the world was coming to an end.
What time of the year do you think?
It was in, it's been so long, but it was in the summertime.
What hour of the night do you think it was?
It was about 8, let's see. It was after dark. It was about 9 o'clock. About 9 o'clock. It was early spring or late fall, or in early fall, but I think it was early spring. But it was just the sky was in. I mean, not in one spot. It was the whole sky.
Did you ever see it, Jack?
Never.
So that was.
There was people seen it for ever so far, and they never.
Was there ever any publicity on it or explanation?
No. There never was no publicity on it. People was afraid to talk about it. They really was.
I saw
it.
My dad seen
that they was up to my grandmother's and they come home and they didn't know what it was.
This was just on one night.
One night. Never was seen no more after that.
Jimmy, what do you think it was?
Well, I don't really know, Michael. I don't know. I wouldn't have no power to say what it was, but it was something I never saw before.
What comet was it?
Oh, no, it was all, the sky was lit up
the
red.
The sky was lit up. I mean, you know how Jell-O looks when you got it in a pan, if you chop it up. But the heavens was just in a pure quiver.
It just looked like blood.
And people, like I told you, lived on that fur hill. They was one guy. It was cold. It was pretty chilly. I think
it might have been in the fall of the year.
It was the fall of the year. This one guy had long johns on. He run from the top of that hill. He was so frightened. He run from the top of that hill all the way into our home, hollering and screaming. They just thought the whole heavens was on fire. I mean, it was all over.
It was really scary.
There was a lot of talk in those days about the end of the world.
Remember? Right. Yes, indeed.
I remember that. People would give away their things and go up on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great wave of fear of the world coming.
Yeah,
in.
Right.
I remember that.
But some of them said it was caused from the Northern Lights.
I don't think it. I still won't say that. I can't agree with it. I won't agree with it. To this day, I won't agree with it.
You're in a
stuff. No, it wasn't either. I've seen the Northern Lights too. But you've never seen Northern Lights burn like that.
Do you remember any other strange goings on?
Well, no tales. You heard some tales are going on about music going through the sky.
Oh, tell me some of those. Who told those?